So during your time, both in your private practice and as commissioner in these different positions, were you, are there highlights that you think should be noted in terms of
labor lawyer, I think, in Connecticut was Daniel Baker, who got out of law school. He was New York. His family at one point had one of the Borsch Circuit hotels, the smaller one. And Danny went to law school, came out of law school for a little while, worked in the state of Washington. I think he... they set up some model labor laws very early in the 30s, in the early, I think, probably 33, 34. He worked in the state of Washington where there was unemployment. Did they already have an unemployment compensation law? I think they may have had an unemployment compensation law early in the state of Washington. They were kind of, you know, that part of the liberal... people in the western states, I think. Anyway, Wisconsin had some. Well, of course, Wisconsin had a different had the Lafollics. But then he came back and worked for the National Labor Relations Board as a trial examiner. Daniel Baker did. He left the National Labor Relations Board around 1947, 48, and set up practice in Connecticut. First in Bridgeport and then in Stamford. I guess he came to Bridgeport for the same reason I did originally. So, there were a couple of people in Hartford, somebody that just retired, I forget his name for the minute, who was a labor lawyer in Hartford. And I came in, my earliest was really with the garment workers, the National Ladies Garment Workers in Bridgeport. One of the things, again, I guess probably coming out of some of the socialist philosophy, that the garment workers had a plan where they'd get a lawyer and it would be, and he'd be the union lawyer, but he could... members could consult. The consultations would be no cost to the members. You know, this kind of legal insurance way back, I'm talking about like 1950, 51. And that I think was my first union, was probably, I don't know exactly how, whether it was John that suggested, I don't know, but because at that time they were AFL, the ILG was AFL. Maybe Joe Rourke, who was AFL, he had been a state senator, and he had been an electrical worker, and he went with the CBs and during the war, and then he came back, and he ran for a representative when he came back, but he was still in the Electrical Workers Union, and he became secretary-treasurer of the AFL in the state. Joe Rourke did. And I was friendly with Joe Rourke. As a matter of fact, Norman Zolot, who was a classmate of mine, before I passed the bar and came on, in 1948, he set up an office with me in Bridgeport with Joe Rourke, for the state AFL. Where state AFL headquarters was in Bridgeport then. And that may have been my contact with the, when I started practice in 49 with the, because Norm stayed with that office in Bridgeport, Norman Zolot. And Joe, he was there, where did I meet John? Did I meet John the first ADA after the 46? Maybe where I met John Driscoll. But I knew both of them, you know. And there was no animosity between Joe Rourke and the CIO. I mean, Rourke was very liberal. Maybe the Teamsters weren't quite that. I mean, they were a little more aggressive in their attitude toward the CIO, but Joe was certainly no problem between his theory of the AFL and the CIO. Anyway, so then my first union clients were the garment workers, and there was this attempt. And I used to meet, I don't know, some evening a week that I'd set that any of the members of the garment workers who wanted to get legal advice, I'd give them legal advice, tell them whether they needed a lawyer, they didn't need a lawyer. No, I don't know whether I don't think I was on retainer with the union, but, or maybe I was. Maybe I was getting some money, I don't know. But that was, I mean, just for the advice I meant. I mean, if I had any work, I mean, I would. And then at one point, I remember Dubinsky had a particularly rough struggle with some shops in Meriden, the center of the state, Meriden, New Britain area. They had, during the NRA codes history, one of these people had been on an industry representative on a code formulation, and so had Dubinsky, and he clashed. Anyway, you could never unionize that factory, so that he had a big campaign. He was gonna unionize this factory or several factories there. And there were a lot of Italian workers, so Tyler recruited me to write things in Italian and whatnot up there. I mean, that was hardly legal, but it was a lot of fun. And Dubinsky at that point had begun to train people in a kind of a labor college, and I remember there was a kid out of Princeton who was one of the organizers who had gone through this training. And he was a real Brahmin. One of the miscreants, if you will, the factory owners. Where the hell were we? Wallingford. Yeah, it was Wallingford. This campaign that Dubinsky, he was particularly interested in getting one guy, and I think one guy in quite a few factories up there. But anyway, I remember the Princeton guy yelling all kinds of invective as the owner's car coming into the picket line, coming in across the picket line to go in. Rather real scurrilous language from a Princeton guy. So I represented that local because a lot of people were arrested on the picket line, particularly I thought it might be worthwhile to save the organizer. I mean, I didn't want to give the organizer a criminal record, so I had about 12 people that, and then the usual bit that you do in all-American courts, you get plea bargaining. I mean, you gotta have the guilty here because they actually struck somebody, anyway. But I didn't want the Princeton organizer to get to get a criminal record. I remember that. But I was representing the garment worker, in the Wallingford strike. And in those days, they had the town courts. The court system was not so organized as it is now. Everything is superior court. They used to have town courts, and they used to have grand jury courts in the real small towns. And I'd go up there in the evening, and he'd run court in the evening, the prosecutor and the judges, the part-time political positions, and to accomplish the defense of these poor workers. I represented, that was garment workers. And then from there, I remember getting some work with grievances and the Bridgeport Brass, the local here in Bridgeport. I'm just trying to. Although I did not have the work of the international UAW, but Baker would bring me in if he needed another lawyer on UAW cases, because Baker did have the, because of his NLRB background, he represented quite a lot of the international unions, along with Diamond, who came later. Diamond came out of, he had been a law journal at Columbia Law School, and he joined with Baker. And with Baker, by then, had moved to Stanford. I also represented, in the District 50 kind of situation, they organized rubber workers in Bridgeport. This was, you know, in the 40s. And there was a strike that occurred at the, I see the name when I pass the gravestone when I walk in the morning in the cemetery near here, which is a nice park. Canfield, H.O. Canfield Rubber Company, was near the river, the factory. And there was a strike, and there was an injunction. Injunction got dissolved. Injunction granted in the first place by a Republican appointee to the Superior Court, dissolved by a Democratic appointee to the Superior Court. And then Dan Brennan, whose father had come out of Pennsylvania, he was representing the union. I'm just coming out of law school. He represented the union in that strike. The reason he represented the union, his father represented the union. His father had died, but his father had mine worker contacts, even though his father was a Republican here in Connecticut. And District 50 had organized Canfield Rubber. And Brennan's partner Daly was a Yale Law School grad, but older than I. They had the theory that they were going to sue Canfield, because Canfield, whenever you get an injunction in the practice, you have to give a bond to cover the costs and the guarantee that you will do things that the judge says you have to do. Anyway, theory that Daly developed is that you sue on the bond for the damages to the people, because the damages from the injunction were that they had lost wages, they had done this, they had done that. So they developed this great theory, very interesting legal theory, that you have a property right to a job, and the injunction infringed upon that property right. I mean, it was very advanced, but I don't think the law has come quite that far, although in some ways it has approached that 50 years later. So they needed researchers, and I was just out of law school, and that was really my first labor case, really. I mean, I wasn't the lawyer, though. I was one of the lawyers. Eventually, they settled that maybe 5 years later, but that was great for teaching all of the various motions and whatnot in that case, and they did pay. That was the Canfield Rubber, named by Weicker earlier on. So that the Canfield case was really my first, and that introduced me to, although it introduced me to District 50 generally, I mean, a reintroduction. I mean, I'd had that introduction at Yale, but they were different people. They weren't the same people who had been at Yale. But it also introduced me to the legal staff of District 50, which was Yelverton Cowherd was the attorney for District 50. He also came out of the minefields of ambience, and his assistant was, or maybe Cowherd was for the mine workers, and Alfred Trehearn was the lawyer for District 50 nationwide. That was the... And District 50 had also organized utility workers, gas and water company workers in Bridgeport and New Haven. And they had some strikes. I think that one of the strikes, Brennan represented District 50 for the Bridgeport local. And then I got a New Haven case. I think it was a grievance case out of the New Haven local for the New Haven Gas Company. And then I became the District 50. I don't know how the transition, but I guess Traherne liked me or whatever. And I became the District 50 lawyer, and I represented them in the couple of strikes here in Bridgeport, the gas company workers again. The New Haven Water Company workers, was that the first one over there? And I had the garment workers, and I had the brass grievances. At that point, the brass workers were... the head of the union was a Republican, but it was in Driscoll's union then, I'm pretty sure. Let me see what else. Then I got a case in the 60s with the District 50. I mean, they sort of faded out of the picture, but they were municipal workers in Norwich. Also, they represented the Dow Chemical Company, which was at Allen Point. Was it in Ledyard? I think it was in Ledyard. Anyway, it was in eastern Connecticut. And some flaming Irishman, Michael McDermott, he was a firebrand there. He'd been a carpenter in District 50. And we had a couple of strikes there where I represented them. And then out of that came one... McDermott called somebody a union buster. And he sued him for libel. I don't know what that... I mean, I would think that he'd wear the badge with the grace. I mean, the member of the management. He sued him for libel. And he sued the Norwich paper and the New London paper who printed the story. So I was involved in a lawsuit defending McDermott and District 50. And anyway, it proved to be very profitable, but it just dragged out for 3 or 4 years, and it wound up with nothing. The question of what was libelous and the question of the New York Times versus Sullivan, I think by that time had come down, and so you had big questions. Yale Law School and big law came into the picture from this small. I mean, all right, that one I remember. District 50 out there. Some of the other union cases. In the strikes in the Bridgeport, one of them was involved there putting sand in the gas mains. That wasn't very nice. And another one, the Bridgeport leader was somebody who was a Croatian. But they organized a crew to go to Milford, one of the foreman's houses, and throw balloons filled with paint against the house. You know, they bombed it with paint, and so somehow or another the man had his car ready and he began to follow them, and he thought he identified the people who they were, and so they were being charged with breach of the peace or trespass or some kind of minor criminal activity, and I was defending him. That proved to be a long case, and the union was spending money. I mean, I had maps made of the whole route and whatnot, and I had a ball in that one there in Milford. By then, it was no longer a town court. It was called a circuit court, but later amalgamated into the Superior Court. So then in terms of American, of Connecticut legal history, it was a misdemeanor proceeding in the, one of the first of, you know, involving a strike in the new court, in the new circuit court. Eventually, a couple of people got convicted out of that. I think they had six. They picked the wrong guys, but of course nobody could tell, you know, you picked the wrong guys. I mean, and there was a jury, and there were a couple who had thrown the bombs. They picked, but the people who were convicted had not thrown the bombs. They happened to be in the car, but but of course I wasn't about to tell. So anyway, that was the case. You know, in those days, for the most part, you would be having cases that didn't really involve, you know, the great principles of law. It'd be these, like this minor kind of thing. I mean, the one in Wallingford with the ILG, this one with District 50, you know, because of the picket line activity, you'd have you'd be defending a criminal case, you know. Eastern Connecticut, the amalgamated was in Eastern Connecticut. I don't know whether I ever actually represented anybody, although I may have gotten peripherally involved in some of those. Well, that industry, how dead. Now, the ILG wasn't in Eastern Connecticut. The ILG was pretty much the coastline, and maybe up Hartford, New Britain, Connecticut, or not the Connecticut Valley so much. Yeah, the Connecticut Valley. But they didn't go east of the river. Amalgamated was, for the most part, concentrated east of the river, those small towns. French, Canadian, Italian, women workers, Amalgamated, east of the river. But I don't think I represented, I'm trying to remember, but I just can't remember, but I think I represented Amalgamated, and I can't place any. I represented the Greenwich Local Laborers Union. Greenwich Local Laborers Union was fighting COYA. There had developed in the Laborers International this concept, at least for New England, this concept of the heavy and highway construction. It wasn't only for New England, it also involved New York. Of the heavy and highway construction. And one of the purposes, apart from the fact, was to rational to separate heavy and highway from other construction as a special unit of the industry. But it also provided a vehicle for COYA, you know, out of Providence, Rhode Island, to carve himself out an empire.
COYA, C-O?
C-O-I-A. His son is now president of the union. His son is a lawyer at Providence. President of the union, as a matter of fact, is being investigated now. COYA himself was also with corruption charges or whatever. I don't know whether he was ever, but at any rate, the Greenwich Local is on the border between New York and Connecticut. New York prices were better than Connecticut prices. Part of the strategy of highway and construction was to have uniform rates throughout Connecticut. Greenwich didn't like that. So Greenwich would be fighting heavy and highway. And I got involved representing them in various intra-union disputes. Mm-hmm. And they didn't particularly like COYA, who I think was also the national treasurer of the union besides being a power here in New England. And that dragged out. I mean, I'd managed to keep part of their independence, and they'd be appealing to the National Convention in the usual procedures. I didn't ever get to the National Convention, but I'd be formulating strategy with them. That was kind of interesting. I didn't know at the time what was going to happen later, that the Taft-Hartley mechanism, that Coya himself got targeted. But, you know, the whole, again, in terms of labor history, that in terms of the power of the Laborers International, although I never represented the Laborers International here in Bridgeport, I did represent them at Greenwich Local. Oh, and I represented Hudson Wire in Torrington. No, the case, the law case was Torrington, but they were in Winston. Well, this was after the flood. The flood was 55. Well, this must have been in the early 60s. Let me see. I'm confusing two cases. One, the Hudson Wire case was an arbitration case. Yeah, the Hudson Wire case was an arbitration case, and I won that one. It was the Connecticut Supreme Court, but it was arbitration. I was confusing it with the Torrington case for United. UAW local in Torrington out of a strike. And that's when high-powered law came in. I used the legislation that had passed because of the civil rights struggle, moving state actions into federal courts. They've been a picket line, and the company sought an injunction in Torrington, and I defended the union. And after the second day of the trial on the injunction, I pulled that civil rights statute to get the case transferred to federal court, stopping their attack. Didn't prove successful, but it took 2 weeks before it got back. By that time, the theory was that they could maybe settle the strike. That was one of those plants in Torrent. That was some of the memorable. I'll never forget it. One of the examples that the company was trying to show about the picketers' unruly behavior was that as one of the strike breakers was crossing the picket line, one of the women picketers yelled at her, "I pick better scabs than you off my asshole." that strike. I can't remember anything else about it. I could remember that. that was a breach of the peace, according to the to the company that needed an injunction to stop. Then there were a couple of cases not very successful where the Timex, the watch manufacturers in the Waterbury area, I think there were also UAW. But the movement toward the south, moving workers out of Connecticut and attempting with the contract, the pension funds and whatnot, attempting to to stop it because the contract provided that they were products of negotiation, and then they hadn't negotiated with the union on either, so those suits not turn out to be successful, and they couldn't stop the movement. And I think one of the things also in those things used the idea of the seniority status, that you couldn't destroy the seniority status of these people because the contract guaranteed it by moving the plant, by moving that part of the plant out, you know, that try to use that legal, didn't work. But those were the attempts made to arrest the migration of the jobs. One of the things I became increasingly aware of by the 60s was as the older workers retired, the unions, especially the ones that had been the CIO ones, in their concepts of democracy, insisted that the older workers remain members of the local, which meant that they could vote. And sometimes when they were voting, they weren't really voting the interests of the working members. They were voting their interests. But of course, the union also had become a social movement, not just an economic instrument. So the UAW, which had those provisions, UAW would have senior centers, that kind of thing for locals, and then they lost the jobs, they'd consolidate locals. And that involved sometimes that there was money, if the local had money, that was it the international's money, wasn't the international money, there was some kind of illegal maneuvering in those cases. Same kind of thing that had happened when the anti-communist left had ousted the UE and had ousted the National Mine Mill and Smelter. The same kind of, did the local have the money or did the international have the money, you know, that. Mm-hmm. And that created legal processes.
Were you involved with those? That was very early on. Were you involved, in your legal career?
I wasn't involved with the ouster of the communists, no. I was in law school. I say
49.
Oh, even earlier. Yeah. Hmm. No, this the UE one in Bridgeport, I think, was 46 or 47.
Hmm.
Santignani,
mm-hmm.
was he went with Curry with the IUE. And that was the General Electric, right?
Yeah.
One of the people in the communist left was Josephine
Willard.
Willard Seneza was her maiden name. Willard. I remember she had a following in the union, a couple of black women I remember in the union. At any rate, one of my minor coups is when the House Un-American Activities Committee came to hold hearings in Bridgeport. They wanted to investigate the GE union. But this was history now because the IUE had already taken over. Anyway, Josephine came to talk to me, one woman who was one of her people in the union before the IUU had taken over. And, they didn't want to have all the repercussions of the House Un-American Activities questioning her. So anyway, I figured out the woman had some uterine problems, and I got her admitted to the hospital for that day.
Great.
Yeah. Cards. What'd you do your thesis on?
On the limits of acceptable dissent, political dissent at Yale from the 1920s.
Oh, that's right. You told me that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, you told me that.
Yeah. I was looking at students and blue collar workers and professors.
Yeah, the law school, I guess, occupied a special niche there.
Yeah. Actually, a book had been already written about the law school.
Oh, really? I'm kind of running dry on my labor practice. I think I've plumbed
that's
most
a lot
of it, I think.
That's
yeah.
a lot.